Is everyone okay at the top there? I do apologize for this sort of confusion. I think it's because the previous lecture finished a bit later than usual. Can I also apologize for not being here for last week's lecture? I hope nobody here turned up for that one. The reason was the thing you have to do in this job all the time now, fundraise. I was away on fundraising trip, so still trying to sustain intellectual life in the middle of all the other things that I have to do. So this is key part of it for me. I've got this thing to announce here. It asked me to announce it after the lecture, but I thought I'd announce it before the lecture. There'll be a debate at 2 o'clock in room S600 on the proposition this house believes that Anthony Giddens' third way is socialism in disguise. Well, I encourage you to go. I'm pleased to have debates. Sorry that I can't go to it, but let me tell you how I would answer that in case there's anyone here who is going to the debate. I will be talking about third way politics in the lectures next term. Not this term, because this term I'm talking about the rise and fall of socialism primarily, which gives a clue to what I think about this issue. Third way politics is actually a defense of social democratic values. If you want to call that socialism, it's defense of socialist values, that is, an inclusive society, the belief that one has to combat inequality, and the belief that one has to have a society which cares for the vulnerable. If those are social democratic beliefs, then third way politics certainly supports those beliefs. It's not socialism for reasons I'll be talking about later in these lectures. That is, socialism as an economic theory is virtually dead. No one predicted this would happen, but in retrospect, we know the reasons for it. Those reasons I'll be beginning to discuss today, but we'll also analyze in subsequent lectures. Socialism was, above all, an economic theory. Marx intended socialism not to be an ethical theory primarily, but an economic theory. So it kind of stood or fell by its economic competence. And as we'll be seeing today and subsequently, as an economic theory, socialism has more or less, in the late 20th century, ceased to exist. We now have to defend, in my view, social democratic values, but in the context of a globalized world whose economic structures are quite different from those which Marx and other socialists anticipated. No doubt you'll get, if you do go to this debate, however, a variety of views on this subject, so I would encourage you, if anyone's interested, to go. This is a very interesting transition in politics happening in the world at the moment. And I hope plenty of people in the LSC will be interested anyway in what is happening to especially left of center politics in Europe and elsewhere at the moment. But I will be talking about that directly, as I say, in subsequent lectures. For the moment, I want to use this lecture, which is the last of four lectures this term. I'll be giving four lectures next term, the same day of the week, to finish off discussing the rise and fall of Marx, or the impact of Marx on history and what went wrong with it. Where we'd got to last time, in case you don't remember since it was 2 weeks ago, was the transition point from capitalism to socialism. Marx was the most astute analyst of capitalism. I hope you can recognize, if you look around you in the newspapers or whatever at this moment in history, that many of the things Marx argued about capitalism surely have some substance. Marx argued that capitalism is a system which puts price before anything else, which therefore commercializes things. It puts commercial values ahead of other values. It is a system subject to erratic fluctuations, such that you get periods of boom followed by periods of depression, with large swathes of unemployment. It is a system which tends to polarize between rich and poor on a national as well as a global level. It is a system which tends to produce monopolies, a concentration of power in the hands of very large corporations. On these and on other issues, it would be difficult to gainsay that Marx was right. However, Marx recognized or believed his main contribution not to be about the analysis of capitalism. He thought his main contribution was about socialism and what he called the inevitable I do apologize for the drilling behind. We just employed new LSE dentist who's practicing behind them. practicing, it's not. Marx thought the transition from capitalism to socialism was an inevitable transition, and he regarded his analysis of this transition as his fundamental contribution. I think you could argue it was, because you must remember that Marx changed history. You must remember that Marx did what he set out to do. At least a third of the population of the world, well, more at certain periods, had been living under Marxist governments, and a much larger proportion under socialist governments more generally defined. So Marx did change history. There was something there. We did see some kind of transition from capitalism to socialism, but what he would never, never, I think, have anticipated is that we've seen a transition back again. That is, that socialist regimes are now turning to market economics across the world, signaled above all by the demise of the Soviet Union, East European socialism in the 1989 and 1990 period. So this is a truly remarkable historical turnaround. What did Marx say then about socialism and transition to socialism? He thought, this is where I left you last time, that there could be two types of transition. Both of them would be brought about by the inner dynamics of capitalism, remember? According to Marxian theory, systems tend to transcend themselves from within. You then get a political movement which capitalizes upon the economic changes that have already happened. Capitalism was producing socialism from within itself. Socialism is essentially taking social or communal control of our destiny, according to Marx. Marxian view, it isn't satisfactory to have an industrial society based upon competitive individualism. You need a society which linked to human needs, to the community, to the wider society. Socialism means linking production to the needs of the wider social community. That is the root sense of both socialism and communism, as I mentioned in the first lecture. Transition can occur in two ways. It can happen peacefully, according to Marx. What happens there is that you first of all get a kind of defensive reaction against capitalism in the workplace. Defensive reaction against capitalism is the rise of the labor movement or the union movement. In the early period of capitalist development, Marx points out, workers have no rights. When you enter the workplace, you have no rights over the disposal of yourself or body. You are the property of the employer. Certainly early capitalism, this was the case. The union movement was a defensive reaction to that. It was a collective movement because workers saw they could only defend their position by joining together. The union movement, Marx thought, then would tend to become politicized as it became more national and indeed international. It would lead, therefore, to socialist parties or labor parties emerging within the political sphere. Labor parties in some countries could push through a peaceful transition to socialism. So there could be a peaceful transition based upon the dominance of labor parties representing the majority of the population, the underprivileged classes in the population, who would simply promote a transition along the lines I'll go on to describe. This was another thing that Marx was right about, because in virtually all countries there was the rise of a labor movement, there was the rise of labor parties or socialist parties. The United States is usually reckoned to be the only society which has not produced a significant socialist alternative to conservative parties. But of course, many people would say the Democratic Party was essentially a quasi-socialist or labor party anyway, since it tended to be linked to the interests of organized labor. From that, it would follow that Marx was correct in projecting the rise of labor parties as significant political actors or socialist parties in the industrial countries. This is something which happened after Marx's death, so it would certainly count as a genuinely verifiable prediction. The alternative route to revolution is violent. Marx thought this would happen in countries where there was very strongly established dominant class with repressive state institutions that could only be changed through active confrontation. Some subsequent Marxists argued that the only effective revolutions are violent revolutions. This was the kind of view which the founders of the Soviet Union took. Lenin, the prime founder of Soviet society, tended to argue that revolution needs to be violent because it's only through violence that you can overthrow the existing structures. If you don't produce a direct confrontation with those structures, you tend to accommodate yourself to them, and in the end you don't change them very much. The sort of path, you might argue, which parliamentary socialism actually took in the West European countries, an accommodation to capitalism rather than an attempt to actually overthrow capitalism as a society and a system of production. Remember, Marx thought that Russia could be the sparking point that would join the two together. You might have a violent revolution in Russia on the margins of capitalist development. This might spark a series of more peaceful transitions in the European countries, Marx thought. Of course, his prediction about Russia came true, but the core of his prediction, that there would be revolutions in the West European countries, did not happen. There were revolutionary periods, for example, in 1917. It was not just Russia, it was also in European countries. There were various revolts and uprisings, but there was no revolution in the European countries, or much less North America. And now there never will be a revolution, for reasons that I'll go on to discuss subsequently, because there no longer is a working class, the main class in which Marx pinned his hopes. Or at least the working class has become a much more minor part of the industrial countries than it was in Marx's day. The dream of proletarian revolution is certainly now one of the dead dreams of history, and a dead dream forever, I think, in history today. What kind of society did Marx anticipate a socialist society would be? Socialist society of the future, Marx argued, would be a classless society, a society without classes. And the reason for this is quite straightforward and quite powerful. In the past, you remember, there have been classless societies based upon poverty or lack of development. The early forms of primitive communism were classless societies. They were classless societies based upon deprivation. There wasn't much wealth to go around. The classless society of the future, Marx argued, would be a classless society based on abundance. It would be based on the fact that industrial production can create so much wealth that that wealth can sustain a diversity of forms of lifestyle, a society in which no one needs to live in poverty and no one needs to be seriously deprived. To be a classless society, there's a fairly simple backup for this, because private property will not be the organizing mechanism of industrial production. Marx thought that a capitalist society is an irrational way of organizing the fruits of industrialism. It's irrational because it's based on a kind of uncontrolled competition between thousands or millions of capitalist producers. We need to link this system to our own history, which means we need to take control of it, which means that private property will become no longer relevant to it. Marx thought he had a way of demonstrating this in the sort of latter phase of the development of capitalism with the rise of the joint stock company. Joint stock companies tend to become prominent in a period of monopoly capitalism, when large corporations dominate the economy. Joint stock company is a company in which thousands or maybe millions of people own shares. In ICI or General Motors, shares are owned by millions of people. Now, in such companies, Marx thought, control over the company is no longer in the hands of those who own capital, the shareholders. There are so many shareholders that they can no longer control these big companies. Capital, therefore, Marx thought, private property, even within a capitalist society or in the last stages of a capitalist society, has here become detached from economic control. He put it in this way in a famous phrase, the joint stock company. Is capitalism without the capitalist? Capitalism without the capitalist. In other words, in a large company, it's the managers, not the owners, who run the corporation. That shows you, you don't need private property effectively to run a modern industrial system. What happens, therefore, after the stage of revolutionary transition is, in a way, the whole economy would be run like a large company. Private property would no longer be relevant to it. It wouldn't be who owned capital. It would simply be a managed economy with planned production, in which production would be planned according to human need rather than according to the vagaries of the marketplace. So Marx thought that control of enterprises would be progressively shifted into the hands of government, and government, democratically elected government, would provide the means of creating direction for economic enterprise. That is essentially what happened in the Soviet Union. In the Soviet Union, there was a process of rapid collectivization of farming and industry. The individual owners of industry and farms were put together in collective units. They were administered by the state, by government, not by private individuals, not by private property. That's why the Soviet Union, strangely to external observers, always saw itself as a classless society, a society on the way to eliminating classes. Classless society, in sum, is a society where private property no longer dominates economic or political power. And this was true of the Soviet Union, because in the Soviet Union, for example, you couldn't get to the top through wealth. Private ownership of wealth didn't really mean a great deal in the Soviet Union. It was a kind of consumer privilege rather than a means of rising to the top. There weren't wealthy people who could pass on inheritance to their children. It wasn't a society where money actually counted for all that much. In large sectors, it was a non-money economy. People had loads of money, but they had nothing to buy, nothing to spend it on. It was very different from a Western market economy, whatever its other defects. A classless society, Marx says, is not a society without inequality. It's not a society of uniform greyness. It's not a society where everyone becomes the same. That isn't what a classless society means. Classless society is about the mechanisms of economic control. It's about regulating production so as to make it more effective. It's about ironing out the problems of erratic, fluctuating capitalism. It is certainly about redistributing wealth and income. But Marx argued in a socialist society, people would be able to develop their own individual talents and capacities, and they would be given the freedom to do so. Now, Marx reckoned there were two phases in the development of the society of the future. The first phase, he didn't call it this, but later Marxists came to call it this, was the phase of socialism. And the second was the so-called higher phase of communism, second phase development of a post-capitalist society. the socialist phase of development was a sort of transitional period. Marx thought that immediately after a process of transition had occurred, you're starting to get rid of market mechanisms, you try and democratize the society further. In that kind of society, you have a lot of remnants of the past. So you have a lot of, for example, the old dominant class still has some power, old landowners still have some power, mechanisms of inequality are still alive. In that kind of society, therefore, which Marx thought might go on for many decades, you're struggling to break free from the past. During most of the period of his existence, the Soviet Union believed itself to be in the socialist stage, a society trying to break free from global capitalism, but not having yet moved to the higher stage. The higher stage of socialism or communism, according to Marx anyway, would involve two things that, first of all, might sound improbable or even ridiculous, but they're not actually. They're quite sensible and interesting ideas that still have some relevance today outside of a socialist or communist context. One was what he called the abolition of the state. By the way, this period, socialist period, is characterized by what Marx called the dictatorship of the proletariat. When Marxism was still alive as a doctrine in the Soviet Union, as it still is in China, what the dictatorship of the proletariat meant was a very contentious issue. Lenin tended to interpret it to mean his own dictatorship, and Mao did the same. But arguably, Marx really meant a society in which the majority, for the first time, would be on dictating terms to the richer minority. Because the term dictatorship didn't have the kind of fierce sense that it later acquired. But that term, anyway, was very contentious within Marxist circles for quite a long while. The second was the abolition of the division of labor in industry. I'll explain what these things mean. By abolition, Marx didn't mean getting rid of the state or getting rid of the division of labor. He meant transcending and reorganizing them. The abolition of the state means the transformation of government and the transformation of democracy. Marx believed that capitalist democracy was not democratic enough. He certainly, although he's a bit ambiguous about it, he certainly seemed to support the progress of parliamentary democracy. But he regarded it as a sham in several ways. At the time which he wrote, remember, latter part of the 19th century, even though democracy declared that everyone should have the vote, more than half the population did not have the vote. Democracy in most Western countries was limited to people who owned property above a certain level, and women were almost universally excluded from the franchise. Women did not have the vote in most Western countries until well into the 20th century. And of course, women had to actively struggle to get the vote alongside men. So Marx thought this was a sham. Why proclaim universal political rights and then most of the population are denied these rights? He also thought it was a sham in another way. I mean, he pressed, therefore, for equal rights of voting and democratic rights for women and other excluded groups. He also thought it was a sham in a more profound way because he thought, well, you get to vote once every 5 years, but what use is that? You vote for two political parties or two or three or choose between them that seem to be more or less the same anyway. All you seem to do is be in a position to have elites circulate who then tell you what to do anyway. Where is the democracy in that? Marx thought, therefore, that we should have more democracy, both within politics and in other spheres. He thought that politicians should be recallable, that there should be a more fluid system of officialdom in the civil service, that people shouldn't just be unaccountable civil service officials. And he thought that there should be economic democracy alongside political democracy. Because he thought you have these rights of voting, but again, when you walk into the factory and you start to work is a main part of most people's lives. What rights do you have? The only rights you have are negative rights fought for by the union movement. We should therefore have democracy within the industrial sphere. Most communist countries, and quite a range of capitalist countries too, have striven to attain this. Germany is probably the best example in the so-called stakeholder model of German capitalism. By the way, there is a debate about this, which I'm chairing at 5:30 or 6 o'clock tonight in the Old Lecture Theatre, about shareholding versus stakeholder capitalism. In German stakeholder capitalism, employees do have the right to elect representatives to boards of management. That system has never been very popular in the UK or the US, but it's firmly established in Germany. That's the sort of thing that Marx had in mind, although I think he wanted a more radical version of it than you find in most Western countries. So the abolition of the state really means the further democratizing of government, and the attempt to make sure that state officials do not become unaccountable in respect to the populations whom they govern. Abolition of division of labor means the same thing, the transformation of work. Transformation of division of labor means division of labor between different jobs or occupations that people do in industry. Marx thought the division of labor as it existed simply denied people the right to express their own creativity in work. Marx says in a capitalist system, you have lots of people working on a production line, for example. They might do the same thing all day, routine set of operations all day. What kind of life is that for people? What is the point of having a system that delivers so much wealth, but at the expense of denying people any kind of creative involvement with their work, work again being a core part of human life? And so Marx says in work, the humans become animal and the animal human. The humans become animal because a monkey could do what human beings do on a production line. What is the human rationale for that? There is none. Marx had an interesting set of comments to make about this, because he linked the transformation of the division of labor under socialism to the progression of automation. He was one of the first authors in the 19th century to discuss the impact of automation in industry. And he thought what would tend to happen is a kind of progression like this. Say you first of all take a industrial task, like, for example, let's say the task of a stonemason. Stonemason originally is an artisan, and the stonemason has control of all aspects of his works. A stonemason is someone who can construct a monument in stone or a gravestone, whatever it might be. It's a kind of total product. The individual has knowledge and skill which allows him or her to produce the whole product. With the progress of capitalism, Marx thought, you get the development of what he called the detailed division of labor. Detailed division of labor means breaking down the task into its component parts, mechanizing them, and then having a system in which each individual only does one part of the total task. So in modern systems of production, in stone masonry, for example, it's no longer a craft occupation. It's done by machines, and individuals working on these machines do relatively unskilled tasks. The detailed division of labor breaks down a skilled job into a load of less skilled jobs in order to increase productivity, and it does increase productivity. However, Marx thought, especially in a socialist society when you try to reorganize these things consciously, you would have a phase beyond the detailed division of labor, and this would be the phase of automation. Because if you've reduced what the stonemason does to a series of just individual small tasks working on a machine, why can't other machines then take over those tasks? Why can't other machines take over the kind of machine-like work which you've given human beings to do. So Marx thought that what would happen in a socialist society is you'd get rid of a lot of the drudgery of industrial production by a further element of mechanization, which is automation. You would remove most of the more boring jobs, mundane jobs that people have to do in industry. Rather than creating unemployment, he believed anyway, this would create a kind of fluid division of labor for jobs that people did. He seemed to have foreseen a reduction in the number of hours people worked, much more flexibility in work. He thought, for example, that some professions tend to dominate their clients, and there should be a more kind of liberal shared division of labor, which would improve everyone's lives. So he thought the medical profession, for example, could easily give some of its knowledge to patients. There could be patient power, there could be other forms of power, which would make for a more fluid division of labor. So he thought through these two mechanisms, you'd be able to create a society where probably work would be less important, but where work would be more involving than it is in a capitalistic society. These predictions have only partly come true, but the thesis of automation has in some part come true, as you'll know, not in a socialist context, but in a capitalist one. In most areas of the motor car industry was one of the most soul-destroying forms of production line to work on. Named after Henry Ford, this came to be called Fordism. Fordism was mass manufacture on the assembly line. Cars were made on an assembly line. Individuals might spend all day screwing a bolt in a hole or putting a bit of fabric on a door. But now these things are automated. In most of the advanced car manufacturing plants, it's robots rather than human beings who do these relatively simple tasks. What hasn't happened is a release of the kind of creativity and fluidity in other parts of the system that Marx anticipated. These things having been said, it's important to emphasize that Marx didn't say a great deal more about what a socialist society would be like, and this is either famous or notorious depending on how you look at it. Marx thought he didn't want to present a complete blueprint for the future. People who presented a complete blueprint, he thought, dangerous, because you can't know the future. All you can know is that certain possibilities will be there. He thought you relapse into utopian socialism, and remember, he didn't like utopian socialism, if you create some elaborate view of what society must be like. So he said, I'll just give you a few indications of what the future will be like, and then you have to make the future yourselves after a transition to socialism. This was a problem for the first Marxist revolutionaries, because in a sense which they didn't know what to do. They were supposed to be following Marx, but they only had a few clues from Marx's writings about how they were actually supposed to put all this in process. Well, Marx did change history, and out of Marx's input into history, there arose essentially three main branches of socialism. If you regard socialism as a kind of encompassing thing, including Marxism, but also other variants too. First of all, after the revolution of 1917, Soviet Union, later in China, in Cuba, and in many other countries across the world, which experienced Marxist revolutions, these were dominated by a particular outlook that came to be called, Marxism-Leninism. Based supposedly upon Marx's scientific interpretation of the transition from capitalism to socialism, but added to this the impact of Lenin. Lenin argued for the importance of what he called the vanguard party, the party which reorganizes the society. He sought to make the Soviet Union a one-party state dominated by the Communist Party. The vanguard party was a key idea of Leninism. It wasn't really there in Marx. Lenin added this, and it became a core part of the ideology of these countries. So Marxism-Leninism was official Marxism for a period of something like, 70 or so years, which is quite a chunk of 20th century history. Marxism-Leninism was an important political philosophy. Remember, however, it's only post 1945 that you've got any other Marxist society apart from the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was the only one which existed for more than 50 years, more than half a century. In Western countries, you have the rise of parliamentary socialism, sometimes called reformist socialism, involved in socialist or labor parties. Reformist socialism or parliamentary socialism believed in a great deal that Marx had to say, but thought that you should only take the peaceful path to transition. Parliamentary socialists were against Marxism-Leninism because Marxism-Leninism stressed violent revolution. The parliamentary socialists wanted a peaceful transition within parliament to a more just and equitable order. Nearly all of the existing labor parties, center-left parties in Europe, have their origins as Marxist parties. This is true, for example, of Gerhard Schröder's party in Germany at the moment, the SPD. The SPD, the Social Democrats in Germany, began as an explicitly Marxist party. Engels had quite an impact on it. It was the first mass socialist party. It started as an explicitly Marxist party. This was true in most Western countries. Britain is one of the exceptions. Here there is, of course, a socialist party, the Labour Party, but Marxism was never quite as important in its origins as it has been in most of the other West European countries. At a subsequent period, most of them repudiated Marxism. The SPD in the post-war period broke with Marxism, and most parliamentary socialist parties did, at some point, explicitly break with Marxism. Now they've broken with socialism, which we'll be seeing next term. Most socialist parties have changed their name, or many of them have changed their name, post-1989. They're not just broken with Marxism, they've broken with socialism more generally, for quite good reasons, I think, anyway. Necessary reasons. Thirdly, you had the tradition of what came to be called Western Marxism. Very, very important in the intellectual and political life of post-war Europe and South America and other places. Western Marxism was people affiliated to Marxism or to communism working outside of the Soviet Union and the other Marxist-Leninist societies, but committed to Marxism. Western Marxists were critical of the Soviet Union. They thought of the Soviet Union as a degenerate workers' state. Western Marxists wanted to change both the Soviet Union and Western countries. A whole variety of major thinkers in the post-war period would be lumped together under the category of Western Marxism, such as Jean-Paul Sartre in France, for instance. Good example of sort of earlier period, or if you've heard of him, Jürgen Habermas, probably the most famous social thinker of the current period, explicitly affiliated to the tradition of Western Marxism. Western Marxism has also collapsed post 1989. All of this has more or less collapsed post 1989, which is a quite remarkable thing. Now, when you start to look for the reasons why it collapsed and what went wrong with socialism, you have to start with Marx himself, and I'd like to conclude this lecture just by briefly listing some of the structural problems inherent in Marx's ideas. Some of these problems really only came to surface later on, but it's clear they were there from the beginning. They came to the surface for reasons I'll mention in subsequent lecture, only later, some of them anyway. I'll trot through them very briefly because there's not that much time left. First of all, basic problems with Marx's ideas and with subsequent Marxism on the level of economic theory. Marx, like other socialists, advanced what in modern terms you would call a cybernetic model of economic management. What Marx thought was a market is an irrational, is not a rational way of organizing a capitalist economy. We must have more steering, control, management, planning. We must plan the economy in order to relate it to human need. It seems a good idea. Planning means having something like a cybernetic monitor. Cybernetic monitor means a regulator, a higher order of consciousness that regulates a system. So, for example, the thermostat is a cybernetic monitor in a central heating system. The brain is a cybernetic monitor of the activities of the rest of the body. Marx thought you could largely transfer economic control to a directive intelligence, and that directive intelligence would be government. That was the basic theory of Marxism and of socialism. Well, it's proven to be wrong, or at best only partial. In the case of a modern market economy, as experience has shown, and the problems which the Soviet Union got itself into showed, you cannot substitute systematic centralized planning for the operations of markets, or you can only do so to a limited degree if you want economic efficiency and indeed even equity. The reason is that in a highly complex system, you can't get enough information, you can't get it quickly enough, and you can't take enough rational decisions about it if you're government, if you're the directive intelligence. Only markets can do it. You need an awful lot of low-level signaling on the ground, which signal to millions of buyers and sellers what they should do. And no one at the moment knows a substitute for price and profit as the mechanism for doing this. This has become increasingly clear, and it's kind of exploded the very economic basis of Marxism and of socialism more generally. I'll say something more about it in subsequent lectures, since it is very important. Second, Marx was wrong about capitalist prosperity. Marx thought that, and forgive me for saying these things dogmatically, but it's just limitations of time, really. I'll come back to some of them in subsequent lectures. Marx thought in a capitalist society there would be limits to the productivity of capital inherent in the system because of its tendency to crisis. So he thought a capitalist society could not produce general prosperity for people. You would tend to get a division between a small minority of richer and richer people and a large majority of impoverished people. Now, capitalism does not produce equality, but it does produce rising prosperity, and almost everyone shares in this prosperity. If you look at the economic conditions of Britain in 1900 and you compare it with the economic conditions today, even for people in the poorest occupations or in the weakest sections of the society, their income is about 4 or 5 times what it was at the turn of the century in real terms. Capitalism is a system which produces prosperity in a way which no other system has managed to do, and this certainly includes Soviet communism. This has proved an explosive discovery, really, for those on the left who are still struggling to see how they can accommodate to it. Third, Marx had major problems with ideology. The Marxist society of the future, the classless society of the future, Marx thought would be a post-ideological society. You would not need ideology because there would not be classes. You could therefore argue that Marxism had very little protection against itself being used as an ideology. And I think you can say that's exactly what happened in Soviet-style society. Marxism was used as an ideology of domination, which produced a society in which the Communist Party and the cadres of the Communist Party had a position of power well above probably any group in a Western-style society, which tends to be more pluralistic. Soviet-style societies, Marxism became an ideology. It didn't have the defense against this, which it should have had if it had paid more attention to liberalism, I think. And this has always been a problem, the status of Marxism as a supposedly a post-ideological system. It cannot be a post-ideological system if ideology means how you defend power. Fourth, ecology. Marx was a child of his time in that he believed in economic advance, the advance of the forces of production, the advance of industrialism. He wanted to create a more wealthy society, and he wanted to use that wealth more rationally than a capitalist system can do. Consequently, he had paid very little attention, really, but nor did non-Marxists either, to the impact of industrial expansion and technology on the fabric of the earth. Ecological questions are at best only a very minor aspect of Marx's writings and of the emphasis of subsequent Marxists. So you find that even though the West has a very poor ecological record, the East European countries had the worst ecological record of all, and the pollution problems which are faced in Russia today are absolutely frightening, and they're problems which certainly bear on the rest of us. You cannot have, in the late 20th century, a critical theory of society which is not anchored in the ecological crisis. Marxism does not, by and large, provide such a theory, and this has emerged again as a fundamental weakness and problem of it. Finally, perhaps in a way most interesting and certainly most subtle of all, the problem of history itself. Marx thought that we can understand history in order to change history. The whole point of Marxism was that collectively, as human beings, we will take control of our own history. That was Marx's theorem. We would understand history in order to master our history. That was the theorem of enlightenment. Marx was a child of enlightenment. The idea is the more we get to know about the world, the more we can control the world for human needs. The late 20th century has shown us that this premise, attractive though it is false, that there is something much more complex involved in the relationship between human knowledge, history, and control. The advance of human knowledge, including science and technology, does not lead simply to a world more and more under our control. In some respects, it produces a world out of our control, as you can see from the very ecological crisis itself. The ecological crisis is not a crisis of nature, it's a crisis of human intervention in nature. Science and technology have created many new risk situations for us which were not anticipated in the 19th century. The overall issue then, fundamental enlightenment issue, is in some part behind the struggles of socialism and capitalism in the latter part of the 20th century. History will not bend itself to our will in the way in which Marx believed it could and should. Well, I hope to see you all again next term. It's a bit early on, but I wish you happy Christmas anyway. Look forward to seeing you some point in January. Thanks very much for coming.